Borglund says the news can be so biased that it provides a slanted filter instead of delivering just straight news. My kids are very susceptible to that, she says, explaining that they don't understand they are only seeing one point of view instead of the whole story. Even though I think my kids are intelligent enough, it's what's coming at them all the time. And a lot of what portrayed itself as news isn't really news. It was propaganda. And they saw it as sometimes there was truth, but a lot of times there wasn't. And then all of the things you taught them start coming apart, she says. Both Borglund's daughters, a high school student and a college sophomore, despise Trump. She gets that, but she's uncomfortable with the thought process behind it. It was based on things they saw online, which turned out not to be factual. That process bothers me. That process of not digging in to make sure you have all of the facts. I'll tell you, I did not feel good voting for Trump at all, says Borglund flatly, because I didn't like him. I just didn't like him. But I knew things that were important to me were at stake, like the direction of the Supreme Court and the protection of gun rights. Like many voters who had questions about his temperament and character but voted for him anyway based on their concerns about the Supreme Court, Borglund feels like the calculated political bargain paid off. I will say this. He's impressed me much more since then. I like him more now. The one thing that I like about Trump now is at least he says what he's going to do. And he doesn't try to pander to the audience. And the problem I had with Hillary Clinton, because I really disliked her. And I know people are like, but you're a woman. And I am like, I'm not voting gender. I disliked all of her lies. For Borglund, Clinton's mishandling of classified information with her home-brewed email server that circumvented the security process at the State Department while she served in Obama's cabinet could not be dismissed. So, I work at a defense contractor. We deal with classified information. Everyone understands how to handle information at that company. There are 500 people that work there, and that's one site. There's multiple sites. There's no way that in her position, she didn't know what she was doing with the information. I mean, I have to tell you the amount of checks and security that we go through. And it's insulting for people who understand that for her to sit there and lie, she says. Many Democratic operatives are convinced Clinton's email scandal only became politically lethal because FBI Director James Comey released a letter to Congress in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, indicating that while he had exonerated Clinton of a crime in the act, he had struggled with the decision. Democrats say they saw a measurable dip in Clinton's poll numbers as soon as the letter became public and brought the scandal back to the forefront. Even the National Rifle Association featured her lying about her handling of classified information in its late campaign advertising, paired with her position on gun control in pricey primetime ads aimed at Rust Belt voters during the World Series between the Chicago Cubs and Cleveland Indians. Borglund shifts back to culture and how the media looks at women like herself and Amy, who check the box on everything you are supposed to achieve as a feminist and are befuddled. We're in flyover land, so we're not New York, we're not L.A., we aren't women who feel as though we have to do what pop culture and politics dictate, so we have a brain. Seeing the derision of Trump voters by talking heads on national television irks her. We're not crazy, how people try to describe Trump supporters, especially the female ones. So many of the celebrities and the women on The View say rather indignantly, how could any woman vote for him? Did I like that he said what he said in the Access Hollywood tape? No. Do I like everything that my husband says? No. Amy would just like to enjoy sports or entertainment without an actor or actress or singer or quarterback preaching politics to her. You know, I am just tired. It's like, come on, just sing for us. But at the same time, they're Americans too, and they have every right to voice their opinion. But sometimes, I just want to watch Real Housewives and just veg out without Andy Cohen calling me, a Trump supporter, stupid. I can deal with it if they have an opinion that's different from mine. Just stop being so damn rude about it, she says. The all-out assault on Trump by leading figures in entertainment and media is a contributing factor to the galvanizing of his support in places like Kenosha, even as his administration struggles to find legislative success. In many ways, Trump voters like Amy see themselves behind the siege walls with him, even if he is more conservative than she is on issues such as abortion. And also, it was insulting to have them pick out things and attack Donald Trump for it, when I'm like, wait a minute, Clinton did the same thing. I don't like that at all. I don't like how he debated. I don't like how he handled himself at all. I just took a look at what he said as far as policies go. I'm pro-choice. He said he's pro-life, but he thinks the states should decide. That's what I want in my conservative government. I want to be able to live where I can vote and make that decision. I want to live in a place that's pro-choice. And I know that's different than how my friends feel. But I don't want government telling me that the whole country is going to be that, says Borglin. These Trump-backing women who dislike many of the crude things he says or his impulsiveness on Twitter find a silver lining in his communication style, authenticity, and pugnaciousness. I also like that if they ask him, he'll say something even if it's very unpopular. He's not judging how people are going to take it or trying to find the ways to make everyone happy. You didn't feel like he was trying to pander. I didn't like everything that he had to say, but I felt like that he owned it. And I wanted straight ownership, says Borglin. For her, the Clintons' opposite style of speaking in measured sound bites is part of what's wrong with politics. Every word out of Hillary's mouth was so artfully crafted. Everything Trump said was inelegantly delivered. You knew what was going on in his head, says Maurer. Trump's candor, and even his fabrications and verbal gaffes, reinforced his authenticity as a non-politician. When the press picked Trump's words apart for strict fact analysis, voters assumed he spoke directionally. The press took him literally, but voters like Borglin took him merely seriously. Borglin believes Trump's win realigns politics in the same way that Bill Clinton's did. Yeah, I think, yeah, it has changed things. I mean, similar to when Clinton first went on The Tonight Show. With the saxophone, Maurer interrupts. In Wisconsin, that sense of a new movement, one that pushes back against big government elitism, predates Trump. It can be traced to soon after Walker was elected governor in 2010 and immediately passed a law known as the Wisconsin Budget Repair Bill, sparking months of protests led by liberal groups and state employee unions that culminated in a divisive statewide recall election in 2012. Walker and the Republicans prevailed in that recall and have lost only one statewide election since, after decades of Democratic dominance. For us, it started with the recall election for Scott Walker, and he won with more margin than he did the first time. I think it was sort of this collective, oh, we don't have to be quiet now. You know, conservative people are conservative. Most people are not the marchers. We're not the in-your-face people. But we voted with our feet. We turned out. And this didn't start with Trump, and it doesn't end with him, says Borglin. The local realignment in Wisconsin politics that benefited Trump seems to have cleaved in two the old New Deal Democratic coalition here, separating the blue-collar trade unionists from the white-collar government unions. That schism is rooted in a fear of what Maurer articulates as a decline in the American work ethic, and one she says worries her about the culture at large. We are struggling hard to find people in the pipeline to come in and do assembly, testing, and engineering. We're running the well dry, and we're fighting for the same resources as the Rockwells, she says, referencing larger companies moving into Kenosha, against whom she must compete for talent. We want the business to come here. The problem is we don't have the workers. And when we are finding people to come in for assembly, their skill level is so much less than it used to be. I mean, they're struggling taking an exam that gets them to like an eighth grade level. And getting people to show up on time, or consistently, or at all, is exasperating, she says. It is those kinds of intangibles in politics and culture that fed into my vote. Mine too, interrupts Borglin, drawing a straight line from that fear to angst over Democratic politicians such as Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders focusing their rhetoric on government safety net programs instead of job creation. That fed into people voting for Trump, that the direction of the country, politics, government, and culture is really going in the wrong direction, Maurer concludes. 9 months after Trump's election, Democratic pollsters Pete Broaddrich and Jill Normington, working for a group closely tied to Nancy Pelosi, delivered that message of tough love to state Democratic leaders. Democrats have a small advantage on health care, but Republicans have more credibility on valuing hard work and the economy, blared a PowerPoint slideshow to House Democratic leaders, analyzing a large survey of white working-class voters in the summer of 2017. Pride in country also played a role for both women. I'm a huge patriot. I always have been. That was something that I really didn't like about the previous administration. I'm a descendant of Betsy Ross, put it that way, through my dad's family, Borglin says proudly. And my dad, well, he was a Marine. So Make America Great Again, it speaks to a lot of people. It really does. Because I think people are tired of feeling like they're getting beaten up. But also, to have an administration basically apologize for your country all the time, it's just hard. It was disheartening. Outside, the rain is still pelting the ground relentlessly. Both women have to leave to take children to different activities. Maurer in her SUV, Borglin in her pickup truck. Not the kind you see on the back roads of Appalachia, mind you. The kind you see in suburbia. Four doors, shiny and new. Dawn Martin, Pleasant Plains Township, Lake County, Michigan. The majority of the time Dawn Martin spends with other women, a gun is usually involved. Breakfast on a chilly summer morning with two Lake County, Michigan friends is no different. She is not only carrying, but the conversation between the three women she is with centers on a firearm one of her students brought to a class she taught just the day before. She brought a gun out that I'd never seen before, and it was huge. I shot it, and it hurt my hands so bad. I was like, oh my God, this is so much fun, she explains to her friends. Martin is picking at her breakfast burrito inside Northern Exposure, a no-frills Lake County diner along Michigan Avenue in Plains Township. The eatery is cheery, with buttercup yellow walls, wood paneling, large bay windows, and photos of local wildlife and scenery added for ambiance. At 50, Martin shows no signs of losing her fresh-faced, girl-next-door looks or cheerful smile as she goes into detail about the previous day's gun safety class, which she taught. The woman to her left owns three guns, all with pink on them somewhere. The woman to her right just purchased her first gun 2 years earlier. Sitting in the Plains Township diner, all three look remarkably unremarkable. Just three regular middle-class mothers having an early morning breakfast before heading off to work. Martin's blonde hair is bobbed stylishly, her navy blue Swiss dot blouse is tailored, and her makeup is simple but elegant. Red lips, some mascara, and blush. All three women were raised to be Democrats. All three are college-educated, and all three point to protecting the Second Amendment as their main reason for supporting Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. "No one saw my vote coming, or at least the reason for my vote," explains Martin. She has three children from her first marriage. The youngest, who is biracial, was adopted as her first marriage was ending. "It was all about protecting the Second Amendment. I'm a huge advocate. Everything else, I guess if I was honest with myself, I could negotiate a little bit on, because I am willing to see both sides and listen to both sides," she says of her independent-leaning tendencies. Martin is an NRA-certified firearms instructor, a certified Glock armorer, a certified NRA instructor on personal protection outside the home, an NRA chief range safety officer, and a Michigan ORV and snowmobile safety instructor. She also owns, along with her husband, Rich, Bob's Country Kitchen, a log cabin breakfast buffet-style restaurant that is open only on weekends, spring through fall, to serve the folks who come from downstate to enjoy the abundant trails, lakes, and rivers of Lake County. "We are only open weekends because of where they are located," she explains. "I'm on the main trail system for the RVs and stuff. My customers are primarily people who come from Indiana, Ohio, places like that, for the weekend. Financially, it doesn't make any sense for me to be open during the week." Her gun safety classes, mostly filled with women, are held in the back of the restaurant during the week, where targets are set up for the students. "When I was growing up, feminism was about empowering women to have choices. Choices outside of what society was then dictating. Well, self-protection is the ultimate empowerment a woman can have. I have been a gun owner since 2001, when the law changed here in Michigan, making it easier to obtain a concealed pistol license. Now she shoots every chance she can get. I'm not a hunter. I don't kill things. But I get out as much as I can, put up targets, just keep myself proficient. I believe in the ability to defend myself and protect myself from any threat, whether it's government or somebody coming meaning to do me harm." Martin gets more than just the confidence of self-defense from her practice. "Actually, shooting a gun for me is relaxing. It's a huge stress reliever." Martin says she became an instructor because she sees the importance of being able to bring others in and have them understand that having a gun, being a gun owner, isn't the stereotype they know from popular culture. "People have a preconceived notion that we're all like a bunch of, I want to use this word carefully, oh, what the heck. They think we are a bunch of rednecks, a bunch of hillbillies, gun-toting hillbillies," she says, and sighs. The last thing Martin looks like is a hillbilly. Talbots, yes. Hillbilly, no. "I want people to understand that there are many reasons to own a gun. And just because you've got one doesn't mean that you're any different than anybody else. It just means that you just have a different level of expectation for yourself. You have to carry yourself in a different manner. You can't walk around with this chip on your shoulder," she says. "If you're a typical road rage person, like I am, you have to remember that when you have to go in the car. You have to hold yourself to a higher standard, and that's important. Being able to separate your personal feelings sometimes and keep yourself, it's a checks and balances system." Three men in county sheriff uniforms walk in and take a seat in the restaurant, wave, and smile. She returns the greeting as the waitress pours her coffee. "You know, your husband was here earlier, just before you got here," the waitress tells Martin. She smiles and replies, "Of course he was." Everyone in the township knows Rich Martin, not just because of the restaurant or the tactical outfit he runs with his wife. He is the newly elected county sheriff, the first Republican to win the office in decades. He won by 80 votes out of 5,233 cast, swept in with the man at the top of his ticket, Donald J. Trump. The waitress, overhearing the conversation, says she can't ever remember a Republican winning anything in her county. Her husband won me over. He came to my door and listened and listened. He probably wished he didn't knock on my door, she says, laughing, but he won my vote. Before moving north to Irons, Michigan, where Trailside Adventures and Bob's Country Kitchen are located, Martin and her husband lived in Kalamazoo, where she was a TSA supervisor for 17 years. He was in law enforcement and also owned a security company that he began at the age of 19. In fact, he was the youngest person ever to own a licensed security guard and investigation agency in Michigan, she explains. Now, as an elected official, her husband has no time to devote to the Kalamazoo company, so she makes the trip downstate several times a month to make sure everything is running smoothly. As with her gun safety classes in Lake County, the Kalamazoo operation has a large number of women as clients. You see, I think that these are the women that the national press does not understand. They don't get the importance of not just owning a gun for a woman, but how to properly use it, and how that knowledge and expertise has given them a different perspective when they walk into the voting booth. They are younger, they are single, and many of them have young children. I think they will have a bigger impact, a growing impact, for a generation or two, Martin speculates. The amount of young women, educated young women, who want to protect themselves and ultimately want to protect their right to do that, is a hidden movement. Survey research shows that this slice of female voters played a pivotal role in the election of Donald Trump. Republican pollster Wes Anderson of On Message, Inc. conducted a comprehensive survey immediately following the election in November 2016 in 8 presidential swing states and found that gun rights were a key motivator for the group of women Trump had the hardest time keeping in his camp, women who were not across-the-board conservatives. 18% of those who voted for Trump told us that before Election Day, they were uncomfortable telling people they supported Trump. That's the shy Trump voter, and it's almost 1 in 10 people in the entire electorate, Anderson says. Who were these voters? They were a little more female than all voters. They were a little more educated than all voters. And a very strong 80% of them said they support the goals and objectives of the National Rifle Association. Anderson's research found that the issue of gun rights cut broadly in Trump's favor, with 47% of all voters saying the potential for the next president to choose up to 3 Supreme Court justices was an extremely important factor in deciding their votes, and 59% saying they had seen, read, or heard about Trump's and Clinton's positions on gun rights. Of that clear majority informed on gun positions, 54% report voting for Trump, while 42% voted for Clinton. And of the voters driven by the potential for Supreme Court nominations, Trump held a 14-point margin, 56-42. The Supreme Court issue was slightly more important to voters further up the economic ladder than those lower down, with 91% of those making over $75,000 in household income saying it was important, and only 9% rating it unimportant, compared to 85% and 14% among the similar-sized group of voters who make $40,000 or less in annual income. Perhaps most significant for Trump, the gun issue held Clinton back in the suburban and exurban counties where she otherwise ran stronger than most Democrats have. On this issue, according to Anderson's research, suburban voters' attitudes toward Clinton more closely mirrored those of rural voters. Strikingly, Clinton's gun position did not even clearly help her in urban areas, with 44% of those voters saying her gun position made them less likely to vote for her, and only 41% saying it made them more likely to support her. Martin believes that women who get interested in self-defense become as instinctually protective of the right as they would of any gender equality. It's hard to take that right away once they have felt that personal empowerment of protection within their own hands, Martin says. They don't have to depend on anyone but themselves. And isn't that honestly the entire core of what the women's movement was all about? It is not some slogan. It's not some hashtag, and it is a real feeling. For Martin personally, the issue of Second Amendment rights drove her vote in 2016. I will always vote for someone who is pledged to protect that. He did that, and I was in, she says. The NRA's ad campaign, which was targeted at the Great Lakes states, was the earliest and most consistent outside allied effort supporting Trump, and it prominently featured women who advocated for the right to self-defense. An early October national television ad, which aired while Trump was reeling from the Access Hollywood tape, featured an Indianapolis lawyer named Christy McMaines, who used her gun to fend off an attacker. A man attacked me in a parking garage, tried to stab me with an 8-inch knife. But I carry a pistol. I fight back. That's why I am still here, McMaines said in the ad. Every woman has a right to defend herself with a gun if she chooses. Donald Trump supports my right to own a gun. Defend your rights. Vote Donald Trump for president. Longtime political analyst Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard credited that ad and the NRA's efforts in general with Trump's margin of victory. There are many claimants to the honor of having nudged Donald Trump over the top, Barnes wrote, but the folks with the best case are the National Rifle Association. Barnes gave particular credit to the ad featuring McMaines and another featuring a young Colorado rape survivor named Kim Corbin, who said, "My fear of firearms disappeared when I got my second chance at life." In Barnes's view, absent the NRA, I think we know how Trump would have fared. He'd have lost. For Martin, the gun range owner in Michigan, her decision to place the Second Amendment issue prominently in her own decision matrix fits with her overall view of individualism. A big part of the problem in our culture is our dependence on things we should not be dependent on, Martin says. We are Americans. That means something. That means figuring it out. Without the government giving us free stuff, without the big banks and big companies making us need them so much, and not feeling as though we are entitled to something once we get it once. Martin says the overexpansion of our country's social safety net has created such a negative sentiment about it that even those who use it resent it. I think history has shown when you are dependent on something, at first you're grateful, especially depending on what kind of a dire situation you're in. Then, that gratefulness soon becomes resentment because there's so much unsaid obligation that they expect from you. They feel as though, okay, we own your vote. This is why you're voting for us, because you're in that house, or you have that car, or you have that free phone because of me. Eventually, you start to resent that, she says. Martin is no fan of big government, and she puts big news organizations in the same category. The big media and the Democrats have not shook off that understanding that we are not beholden to them anymore. We are not dependent on them anymore. We did this thing, and we are not going back. Empowerment, when you are responsible, is a heady thing, she adds, then says her goodbyes. She has target practice in an hour. Kim Dole, Franklin, Vernon County, Wisconsin. Kim Dole grew up in a traditional family setting. She and her mom did all of the work around the home, while her three brothers and father did most of the heavy lifting on the farm where they raised cattle and grew crops. One of my biggest chores was helping Mom clean house and do laundry. Unfortunately, we didn't have a fancy washer, We had the old Ringer washer. It was done once a week, so I remember many times sitting down on the basement steps with my radio, and I would take care of washing clothes, and it would be an all-day thing, she says. We actually got a dryer given to us by my dad's sister-in-law or something, and that was something else, because we had never had anything like that. We'd always hung everything out, so when we got that, we thought we were pretty special. Dull is the opposite of her married last name. Her laugh is infectious, her wit is sharp, and her love of life and family is her center. Like many folks of Norwegian descent, she likes to keep her private life, well, private. At 57, her hair is sandy blonde, with striking silver streaks running through it, making a stunning contrast between her rich, peach-toned skin and penetrating blue eyes. She is built Midwestern sturdy. She and her husband live several miles off of U.S. Route 61, the infamous highway that connects New Orleans with Minnesota, built well before interstates bypassed America's main streets. Long nicknamed the Great River Road by travelers because all of its 1,400 miles hug the winding Mississippi River, it is also now officially designated as such for most of the route. It's the kind of road that passes great big patches of rural geography, tiny towns, hollowed-out industry, and soaring views of the rich soils of our country. These vistas inspired many musicians to sing about the land and its people, including folk singer and poet Bob Dylan, who named his sixth album, Highway 61 Revisited. In his memoir, Dylan calls Highway 61 the same road, full of the same contradictions, the same one-horse towns, the same spiritual ancestors. It was my place in the universe. Always felt like it was in my blood. The counties like Vernon on either side of the Mississippi River, from St. Louis all the way up to Minnesota, have long been Democratic. The rare solid stretch of blue counties on post-election maps in the rural center of the country. But they weren't blue in 2016. And the swing from Obama to Trump in these counties helped flip Iowa and Wisconsin from Democrat to Republican, and they nearly flipped Minnesota, too. Trump carried Vernon County by 4.4%, just 4 years after Mitt Romney had lost it by 15%. President George W. Bush lost the county by 7 points both times he ran, and Republican Senator Ron Johnson lost it in both of his successful statewide races, too. The people of Vernon County work hard and make independent decisions at the ballot box. They don't fit easily into today's Democratic strategy of targeting high margins among the cosmopolitan and the diverse. But the people here, and in counties like them, far outside the orbit of metropolitan Milwaukee and academic Madison, have always been a critical component of Democratic victories in the Badger State. There just aren't enough urbanites to muster a majority in this slow-growth, native-heavy state. Any winning coalition will be built with a fair share of people who live out of the way. 23 counties in Wisconsin switched from supporting Obama in 2012 to Trump in 2016. All but four were rural counties with fewer than 50,000 residents. Trump's margins in rural areas of swing states, even beyond Wisconsin, blew away all previous norms for a competitive presidential contest. Trump lost just 197 of the nation's counties of fewer than 50,000 people, and won more than 1,900 of those counties. The area where Dole lives is the town of Franklin in Vernon County, Wisconsin. It's not exactly a one-horse town, but it is close. Just over 900 people live here, and it has the three unincorporated communities of Fargo, Folsom, and Liberty Pole located within the town's lines, all of which qualify as one-horse towns by themselves, connected by that famous ribbon of asphalt. Franklin is at the same time pristine, beautiful, and isolated. As a girl, Dole felt protected from that isolation, and the unexpected dangers that accompany it by her brothers and father. In fact, she says she never thought of it. All the men carried guns. They all knew how to use guns. She wasn't afraid to use them herself. She just never had to, because her father and brothers were always there to protect her and her mother. I grew up in a two-parent family. We were pretty close. We farmed all our life. We rented when we were younger. I remember it was hard getting by. We didn't have much to go on, but there was always food on the table, and we always made do with what we had. We didn't have all these things like kids have now. We did outside things. We made up our own things, our own games. My dad very much made sure, whether we had stuff or not. He kind of joined right in with us. He was like a big kid. Most of the cousins would know that because they liked my dad a lot, she says, her voice rising as she remembers moments with her father. Family was central. We didn't have much, but you really didn't notice that because we felt happy, secure, she says. On my mom's side, it was a Sunday dinner every weekend with cousins, grandparents, aunts, uncles. The family raised cattle and some crops, including tobacco. Most Americans may not think of Wisconsin as tobacco country, but much of the nation's loose-leaf chewing tobacco, such as the Red Man brand, historically came from here. As a child of the late 60s and early 70s in rural America, Dole and her brothers went to a two-room schoolhouse. My dad taught all the boys how to hunt and everything, but I kind of got left behind on that. Remember, that was the age I grew up in. Her parents stopped renting farms after a while and purchased one when she was in junior high. She married shortly after graduating from high school. We actually lived right in Reedstown for 3 years in a small trailer house, and then we purchased with the help of my father. You see, my dad found this place where we're living actually still now. It was like 3 miles from where I grew up. It's just a small farmette, is kind of what you would call it, she explains. When they were first married, Dole and her husband raised a few head of cattle. We raised them, and then we'd sell them, and we raised tobacco. Then the rest of the acreage my dad farmed, she says. When her first child, her daughter Jessie, arrived, she stayed home and took care of the tobacco crop. After her second child arrived and they got older, she started working outside of the home, first at a nursing home for 7 years, and then in local government as the township clerk. My dad talked me into it because the township was having some issues with their previous clerk, and the books were really bad. So my dad asked me if I'd be interested. Not knowing what I was getting into, so I took it, and boy, did I get into a mess. But after about 2 or 3 years, I got the books turned around, and I did that job, the town clerk, for 20 years, she says. Today, she is the department head at the Nelson AgriCenter, which takes up an entire block in downtown Viroqua, the county seat of this agricultural county that is home to the largest organic dairy cooperative in the country. Occupying the corner of East Decker Street and North Center Avenue, the AgriCenter is a stark contrast to the hip storefronts of nearby places like the Driftless Cafe, the Driftless Angler, and Kickapoo Coffee Roasters on North Main Street. A visual juxtaposition showcasing Vernon County's current marriage between the generational agriculture of its heritage and the groovy, semi-hippie culture that may be its future. Here, downtown, is where the working farmer, mechanic, and homeowner find exactly what they need to make their lives and livelihoods run smoothly. Nelson also manages a deer registration station during buck season, where hunters bring their bucks to register their harvest and purchase ice to preserve them until they reach home. Vernon County is located in the region of Wisconsin called Driftless, a formation of deglaciated topography. It is filled with fertile valleys, plentiful trout streams, herds of deer, and ancient cliffs. Dull says that apart from her BB gun, she really did not use guns as a young girl. But after she married her husband, an avid hunter, the sport caught her attention. I started shooting with him once in a while, and I kind of found out how fun it was to target shoot. That feeling as though I am protecting myself, no one else but me, that was very different from when I grew up. My father and brothers fit that role. Then my husband did. But it was him who encouraged me to do it for myself. First because he wanted me to go deer hunting with him, but then for protection, she says. I had tried deer hunting one year, and I had practiced and practiced, and a lot of things kept going through my head, and my husband kept telling me, "Know your target. Know your target." So I got out there, and I see a deer. But then I heard voices, and I did not know where those voices were. I told my husband, when I got back, I couldn't shoot. I did not know where those people were. And he goes, "Well, did you see anybody?" And I go, "No, that's the problem. How do I know they weren't standing on the other side of that deer? I couldn't shoot." He goes, "Well, you're not..." I don't know how he put it. He didn't feel I was confident enough. And I said, "I guess not." Then she overcame her anxieties and got confident. I think by the next year I carried. That next step, to carry a gun on her person, came only after a lot of instruction. Now she has that knowledge and skill to feel more comfortable home alone, in a home that is isolated. It's a whole mile driveway, so it's kind of back in there. My husband has showed me many times what I have to do to use the pistol. In its campaign to support Trump in 2016, the National Rifle Association aimed its advertising and grassroots activities squarely at women like Dull. One of the NRA's most seen television ads, which ran heavily in the Midwestern Rust Belt states on the Big Ten network that is home to college football in this area, featured a woman in her 30s jumping out of bed after hearing a window break downstairs. By the time the woman grabs the phone to call 911 and rushes to her gun safe across the room, her firearm disappears as the announcer warns that Hillary Clinton would appoint Supreme Court justices who would take away the right to self-defense. The Supreme Court case that drove those ads was District of Columbia versus Heller, a case decided in 2008 that struck down a municipal ordinance requiring any handgun in the home to be kept disassembled in four or more pieces. The court, led by now-deceased Justice Antonin Scalia, ruled that such a restriction eviscerated any practical chance that a handgun could be deployed in self-defense. The premise of the NRA's campaign was that women voters, particularly those in the upper Midwest, would be motivated not just by Clinton's ability to replace the deceased Scalia if elected, but also by the empowerment they'd get from their own right to self-defense. Women are the fastest-growing group of gun owners and concealed carry permit holders in the country, explains Chris Cox, executive director of the NRA's Institute for Legislative Action and its top political strategist, citing data from the Crime Prevention Research Center showing that women now account for 36% of permit holders, and a study showing they are obtaining them 326% faster than men. The national media wanted to portray Donald Trump as anti-woman, and the fact is that he fully respects the rights of women and all law-abiding Americans to defend themselves and their families. We wanted to use the facts to counter the false narrative. Dull likes being in charge of her own destiny. "It does make you feel better. I hope to God I never have to, but it does help that, you know, it is like you said, the way things are going now, though, you may have no choice. This area is becoming thieving and everything else, so you just don't know," she says. Dull has been a conservative all her life, but not a Republican. "Well, I don't want to say fully Republican, because I have done on elections. I don't always vote straight party. It depends, because I do read up on the candidate, and I kind of go from there. So I do veer off once in a while. Her top issue in the last election was the protection of the Second Amendment, which is why she found Bernie Sanders interesting initially in the Democratic primary. He was very pro-Second Amendment, she says of her initial impression of Sanders. But she was also strongly driven by national security. As a mother and grandmother and wife, I wanted someone strong, someone who would protect our treasure, our people. What she remembers distinctly is an early Democratic debate between Hillary Clinton, Lincoln Chafee, Martin O'Malley, Jim Webb, and Sanders, during which Clinton said that the National Rifle Association was the enemy she was most proud of. What was that all about? Dole says. I felt as though people in my community were, you know, being attacked. She was by then turned off by all of the Democrats. I could have gone with Webb, but he didn't stand a chance, she says of the former Virginia U.S. Senator, who had been both a Democrat and a Republican, served in Vietnam, was Secretary of the Navy, and had stronger positions on national security than any other Democrat running. When the general election came along, the same things Dole liked about Webb, she liked about Donald Trump. She liked his strength on national security, his forthright position on guns and the Second Amendment, and plans for changing the direction of the country. But with Trump, she found something else she liked that was unusual for a Republican. It was larger than politics, I think. I believe this election was a rejection of how big corporations, all kinds, have treated people over the years. We've become disposable, and so we've lost faith in them. And that was what I wanted to be part of, she says. We finally said we don't want to be part of that. We want something better. It is not a look backward. It's a look forward. For Dole, the larger business and entertainment culture has made a turn for the worse. Think about how the government has treated our military men and women after they came home from serving all of us. Now think about the scandals with the Veterans Administration. Then think about companies that don't hire people who have served. Or think about how people are portrayed on the news who aren't living in a big metropolitan city. All of these things add up over the years. Dole still likes Trump, a lot, well into his tumultuous presidency. But she wearies of his tweeting. I wish he'd keep his mouth shut. I think he would do so much better if he would just quit tweeting everything or whatever. Just some of the things he had to say and how he was looking forward as trying to better this country I love. But the tweeting? Dole does not want to leave Trump's team, but the chaos he generates with his social media account on an ad hoc but regular basis is starting to wear on her. It won't cause me not to vote for him. But it does bother me, she says. Both of her grown children live nearby, with her first grandchild heading off to college in the fall of 2017, and she is thrilled by his support for the president. She watches his posts on Facebook in support of Trump and says she refrains from responding because of who she is connected to on her own account on the social media platform. I'm Facebook friends with some family that just absolutely hates Trump, so I have to kind of watch letting people know my point of view. That's hard, she explains. You know, to keep my opinions to myself, but you just have to around certain people, because you just don't want it to affect your job. So you really have to watch. Some of the coworkers are anti-Trump, so it's just easier to not get into a discussion with them. My dad always said there's a few things you just don't discuss, politics and religion, except with family or friends. Dole shares a picture of herself that she is not sure even some of her family members would believe was her. So last fall, I went bear hunting with my husband. We know a friend up north and he baits. She says of the legal practice in bear hunting, whereby hunters set up a bait stand of food in one specific spot to lure the bear. We don't do dogs, we bait. And I went with my husband, and my husband has already gotten a bear. So he told me from the time he got his, you need to go start getting your kill tag. Because you have to apply so many years to get a kill tag in Wisconsin. So he wanted me to do it because he thought it was such a big deal. Now, mind you, I've never gotten a deer or anything. But what the heck, she says. So I went. It was fun. And it was kind of thrilling. An accomplishment. Plus, I really wanted the bear meat. The bear meat is actually very good. I'm now tempted to try turkey hunting, because I seem like I have more patience nowadays, and I think I could sit and do that, she explains. Avid hunters consider turkey hunting a refined skill, because the birds have such keen senses that they prove elusive to hunters. As far as having a gun in the home to protect herself, Dull is satisfied. Things have changed in the world. They always do. Each generation, there are new dangers. The world gets smaller. Different kinds of problems happen with each generation. You have to be aware of those dangers, of crime, and how to stay safe. And you have to be able to protect yourself. Protecting those rights, she says, clinched her vote for Trump. There really was no other choice. Remember, this vote was for us. How can you not continue to vote for yourself, your family, your community to move forward? I think many of us did in the past, and we finally looked up and said, what is happening in this is more than politics. This is culture and values, and it is everything. Politics was just the thing making the most noise. And while it is hard to remember every detail of that election, one thing not hard to remember is this was like... Dull struggles with the description, as if there isn't an adequate word to describe it. Awakening? Yes, an awakening, she says. There were so many emotions during that election, and they still continue. Hard to remember all of them, but yes, like an awakening. Chapter 6 Rotary Reliables. Donald Trump's general election gamble, whether he made it deliberately or not, was that he could be the kind of disruptive force needed to widen the Republican coalition that had fallen short in 2012, while not bleeding too many typical GOP voters who crave stability and are wary of disruption. Journalist Jim Tankersley wrote on the morning after the election, Trump's challenge was inspiring the blue-collar whites without alienating the college-educated ones. Trump slashed and burned his way through the Republican primary field, mocking and taunting his well-credentialed opponents all along the way with derisive nicknames such as Little Marco for Senator Marco Rubio, Lion Ted for Senator Ted Cruz, and Low Energy for former Governor Jeb Bush. He threatened to bolt the Republican Party entirely several times, even as he sought its nomination. He bailed out on primetime debates, if only to demonstrate that they got better ratings when he was there. He referred to the Republicans as if he wasn't one, poking and testing the resolve of the rock-ribbed denizens of the very coalition he would seek to coalesce in the general election. Trump's gambit worked, but to be sure, he lost plenty of card-carrying Republican voters in the suburbs, running 5 to 10 points behind even Romney's losing total in bedroom counties surrounding almost every major city in the country. It nearly cost him Pennsylvania's electoral votes. He ran 9 points behind Clinton in suburban Chester County, just west of Philadelphia, even though Romney had carried the Republican bastion in 2012. And even as GOP Senator Pat Toomey was carrying it in 2016, piling up 133,662 votes to Trump's 116,114, Toomey ran up a similar 16,000-vote headroom above Trump in next-door Delaware County, and did 27,000 votes better in Montgomery County, just north of the city. Those defections by suburban Republicans were seen nationwide. Trump, for example, ran 5 points weaker than Mitt Romney had in the Milwaukee suburb of Waukesha County, Wisconsin. 10 points behind Romney's number in Johnson County, Kansas, the affluent bedroom county of Kansas City. And even 8 to 9 points behind him in the signature ruby-red suburbs of Texas's metropolises, Collin County, Fort Bend County, and Williamson County. Of the 44 mega-counties in the nation with populations over 1 million, Trump carried only 3, Tarrant County, Texas, which includes Fort Worth, Maricopa County, Arizona, which includes Phoenix, and Suffolk County on Long Island, New York. Trump's net margin of votes in mega counties was worse than Romney's in 32 of the 44. Press analysis of the election returns and exit poll data highlighted Trump's softness among college-educated voters, but it left out a critical exception to that trend. Trump did very well among the college-educated in counties farther away from major cities. A vital component of the record margins he assembled in those non-metropolitan counties. Part of this schism can be explained by social pressure that might be unique to the 2016 election. In counties with far more than the national average of 29.8% of adults with bachelor's degrees, Trump fared poorly. Of America's 100 most educated counties, he carried only 19. Romney had carried 26 in defeat, and outpolled Trump in almost all of them by significant margins. Simply put, Americans who live their lives among a group of friends and neighbors with varied educational backgrounds preferred Trump more than Clinton or Romney, while college-educated Americans who live exclusively among other degree holders were less likely to support Trump, even if they were otherwise Republican. Trump's performance among college-educated voters who live in counties below the national average in education levels was right on the Republican par, particularly in mid-sized and smaller counties in the Great Lakes swing states that determined the outcome of the election. These voters did not face the kind of social pressure to oppose the lewd and coarse Trump that their college-educated peers did in the suburbs. These people, whom we dub Rotary Reliables, are at the top of the pyramid in their communities, the kind of people who run the factories, banks, and civic organizations. But unlike the upper class congregating in the nation's most elite zip codes, these voters spend much of their lives intersecting not with fellow college-educated professionals, but with working-class voters. They hunt and fish with them. They share PTA duty at school with them. They sit on the same church pews. Unlike the corporate manager who lives in a cul-de-sac outside Dallas or Philadelphia, these college-educated voters in less educated communities knew plenty of people who were not only voting for Trump, but were enthusiastic about him. Among the Trump voter archetypes identified in the Great Revolt Survey, these voters are the most likely to have a college degree and the most likely to have served in the military. They are the least populist among Trump's Rust Belt voters, less likely than other Trump voter archetypes to say corporations don't care if they hurt working people or not. They are mostly conservative, more likely to cite the Supreme Court as a motivating factor in their vote, and less likely to have voted for Obama in a prior election than any other archetype, except the King Cyrus Christians. Rotary reliable voters will be the easiest for the next Republican nominee after Trump to retain in this voting coalition. But, as they are opinion leaders in their communities, that nominee needs to keep their enthusiasm in order to sustain the intensity of his or her non-urban support overall. As Democratic campaigns make a hard push to capitalize on anti-Trump sentiment among educated suburban voters, it bears watching to see if this group sticks with its geographic peers, or can be swayed along with the national narrative. Joe Steele.